Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. We're always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, for poor people in Jacksonville, finding housing that's both affordable and livable can be hard to come by. Finding shelter often means settling for dangerously run-down apartments and dealing with the constant threat of eviction. We'll talk about the housing options available and the hurdles caused by a shrinking federal funding pool. You can join our conversation today at 549-2937. Then later, is there life on Mars? Well, if one girl has her way, there will be. We'll speak with 12-year-old Taylor Richardson, who intends to be the first African-American woman to step foot on the red planet. Plus, the Jax Daily Record's Karen Mathis talks with Jax Chamber President Audrey Moran, and we'll chat the weekend sports with Cole Pepper. But first this hour, the deplorable conditions at local low-income housing project Eureka Gardens captured national headlines when it came to light. Residents were living with dangerous mold, leaky gas pipes, and dilapidated stairs. But those conditions aren't unique to that complex. Many local low-income residents deal with these conditions every day. WJCT's Chasing the Dream is a series examining what housing is available when you're poor and what's being done to help against a public housing system that's underfunded nationwide. Here to talk about this is WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Ryan.
And attorneys Catherine Hansen and Jeff Haney of Jax Area Legal Aid. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You can join our conversation today at 549-2937. So, Jessica, let's start with you. Chasing the Dream is a national public media series, isn't it?
That's right.
So how does WJCT fit in? How did the station get involved?
Well, the whole title is Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. It's a project that comes out of WNET, which is New York Public Media, and it's a multi-platform initiative. That means you'll see Chasing the Dream stories on TV, online, and now on radio. You're about to hear them this week on WJCT. All of it is aimed at providing a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society, basically what life is like below the poverty line. So how does WJCT fit in? Well, WNET offered a grant this year. We were selected as one of 10 stations nationwide who got to do some deep reporting on these topics. We submitted a proposal specifically to focus on housing issues in our area, and we started reporting these stories back in April, actually, and Jeff and Catherine, who are here in the studio with me, are basically our guides for this series. So I got a lot of great information from them about their clients and about what they see every day in Jacksonville, and I'm pretty excited to be bringing the series to our air this week. It'll be airing Tuesday through Friday the rest of this week during Morning Edition.
So why public housing? And is there a preview that you can give us about what we'll hear this week?
Okay. So we have four stories coming up this week. So starting tomorrow morning, we will be looking at specifically voucher housing where the person gets to take a voucher with them and try to find a landlord who will take that voucher. That's one type of subsidized housing that's available. And we're looking at what it's like to be on the wait list for that voucher. People wait sometimes a very long time on the wait list. Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, people can wait up to a few years on that waiting list. That particular waiting list is not even always open. You can't always apply for
right.
Section 8 vouchers. Sometimes it's just a closed application process. So they open it every once in a while, and it is a flood of folks, you know, that go and apply on that particular day. And then usually they're on the waiting list for up to a few years.
And that actually happened back in February earlier this year, that sort of every couple of years opening of the Section 8 voucher wait list. And we were there. We met a family who is in line waiting for the opportunity, I guess, to even get on the waiting list, right? And how does that work?
Yeah, that's right, because folks have to be eligible. You know, so they apply, and there's kind of a basic initial screening done to see if the basic eligibility is there. They go on a waiting list, if so. And then they have to pass another round or two of screening along the way, you know, because if you're on a waiting list for a few years, things change, you know, your income, other things. And so there's another sort of screening just before the time that you would kind of be up up next in line.
Okay. So for our story that we're going to hear tomorrow, the family is a military veteran family. So they had that advantage, I guess you could say, in this process, because there was a program, HUD-VASH, it's called, where they were able to sort of get on a shorter wait list for a voucher, and they're actually about to move into a house. So that is the first story that we'll hear tomorrow morning. The following day, we're going to be asking whether public housing is just a handout. So this kind of gets at maybe some of the misconceptions people have. And it is a very complex process. There are different kinds of subsidized housing. I learned a lot about it doing reporting on this topic.
Right. Yeah. What are some of the types of public housing, Catherine?
Well, public housing is a term that a lot of folks use to refer to all types of subsidized housing. The Jacksonville Housing Authority runs public housing, and they also run the voucher program, which is separate and distinct from what's called project-based Section 8, which are the federally subsidized complexes that are owned by private companies or individuals and are not associated with the Housing Authority. The ones in the news would obviously be Eureka Gardens, Washington Heights, not owned by the Housing Authority, but they also provide low-income housing assistance.
And so what, Catherine and Jeff, what makes you experts on public housing, on subsidized housing? Can you tell me a little bit about your backgrounds?
Well, I actually have a degree from the University of Florida with a specialization in environmental and land use law. So my sort of specialty in housing really started when I came to Jacksonville Legal Aid. Jeff was actually my supervisor. And, you know, at Legal Aid, you get thrown into the mix by representing clients, going to court for eviction hearings, just hearing the stories through intake, having to learn all the different regulations and laws that apply to public and other subsidized housing has really given me a new sort of frame of reference for subsidized housing and just low-income issues in general.
And actually, this woman who we'll hear from in the second part of our series this week, I believe, came to intake with you, Catherine, but did not actually get representation in her case.
Right. Unfortunately, that's very common because we don't have enough attorneys to represent everyone that's in need in Jacksonville. You know, Jeff and another attorney at our office, Don Freeman, handle the bulk of landlord-tenant eviction and other subsidized housing cases for Jacksonville. So obviously, those two attorneys cannot take every person's case. We try to prioritize emergencies. We're always seeking additional funding. More money we have, the more lawyers we have, the more people that we can help.
And in her specific case, she was dealing with, it was basically her word against her landlord's word, and she was very afraid of getting evicted from the complex where she lived. So instead of risking eviction, she decided to leave on her own and find a place. She didn't know where she was going to move, and we're going to hear the story this week. Why are, Jeff, why are tenants so afraid of that eviction threat?
There are a lot of reasons. It's a scary prospect to think about, not only if you, because eviction is a lawsuit in Florida. A landlord has to go to court to evict somebody. Only a judge can order somebody evicted, and then only the sheriff can carry that out. And so it's a scary process because, one, people just aren't familiar with the courts. It's just very foreign to the average person. But the consequences really stack up. If you're a tenant and you think, well, I haven't done anything wrong. I shouldn't be evicted. It's hard to sometimes get the courage to go to court, because if you go to court and lose, you know, cause like you said, sometimes it can be one person's word against another. Mm-hmm. If it's a simple issue like that, you know, a lot of times our cases are different, thankfully, and we've got evidence and all of that. But, yeah, if it's going to be your word against your landlord's or somebody else's, and you think, well, if I lose, not only do I have to move out of here, but now I have an eviction judgment, that's public record. Other landlords that I may apply to can see that. They may say, I don't care what happened. I don't want to hear the story. I just see that you were evicted. You know, keep going down the street.
What are some of the reasons for these evictions? Why do landlords serve these evictions to these tenants?
Oh man, there are lots of reasons. That's a good question. Jessica, your example is a good one. You know, you spoke with a woman whose landlord wanted her to move because they were claiming somebody was living with her. Mm-hmm. Maybe a child's father. And we see this a lot. You know, this is common in the low-income community. If a single mother, for example, doesn't have childcare that she can pay for, she may have a family member who comes over. If she works at night, she may have, you know, either the child's father or another family member come over and provide the childcare at home. Well, to a landlord, that may look like, hey, you're letting somebody live here that's not on the lease.
Yeah.
And so it's not a clear cut, you know, what seems from the landlord's perspective maybe is a really simple thing has a story and a good one at that. But that's just one example. I mean, there are lots of reasons that people face eviction.
And if you're living in a subsidized complex, project-based housing, what is the consequence if you do get that eviction judgment?
Yeah, it's a good question. In subsidized housing, there's sort of an extra, there's kind of an added consequence that somebody in just a private apartment complex wouldn't have. So if somebody in subsidized housing is evicted, they could be ineligible for other subsidized housing for up to 5 years.
Mm.
And we're talking about affordable housing and WJCT series Chasing the Dream. Please, we'd love to have your calls and your thoughts on this. Give us a call at 549-2937. And Catherine, what kind of recourse, you know, once they get a notice on their door saying that they're evicted, I guess from that point to when they come to you, what leads them to you? How do you find these tenants that need your representation?
Well, I like the way you phrase that because that gives me an excellent opportunity to say the first thing that's going to happen is not going to be an eviction notice. The first thing that's going to happen is some sort of other type of termination type notice. So a 3-day non-payment notice, a 7-day notice to cure. And I would encourage anyone who wants legal aid services to come as soon as possible, as soon as they get that first warning notice, because there are a lot of options that you have in the beginning of the process that you're not going to have once the eviction is actually filed. In Florida, there's always going to be some sort of pre-eviction notice that you're going to get.
But people don't always know the difference between that pre-eviction notice and an actual eviction notice, right? I mean, because you see this, I'm sure it's scary when you see this on your door. You know, how can they get in contact with Jack's Area Legal Aid?
They can find us online at jacklegalaid.org. They can also come to our office, 126 West Adams Street. Google us, give us a phone call, 904-356-8371. And it's true, a lot of people confuse the pre-suit notice with the eviction itself. A lot of people come to us and say, I've been evicted, here's my notice. Sometimes the notice actually says eviction notice on the top of it, so the tenant could be forgiven for making that mistake. But I'd encourage anyone who even anticipates they're going to have an issue, while we may not be able to represent you, we can always give you advice. The earlier you come, the more options you have.
And we've got a call now. Hal in Riverside, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I'm glad to hear you guys addressing this topic. My first couple years out of college, I actually lived in subsidized housing, and it was a brand new complex that had just been built. And the time I lived there, I watched it go from this, you know, wonderful, great place in a great neighborhood, and just watched it, you know, descend into, you know, what everybody characterizes public housing as being. I'm kind of concerned. There's a wonderful new. I just saw that Vestcor got the rights to build a new urban loft concept subsidized housing unit downtown. While I'm excited to see the project go up, I'm kind of concerned that how will they manage to keep things up without bringing downtown down.
All right. Thank you for your call. So what about that? What about I think he seems to be touching on the perception problem that we have here. When you have public housing that gets built automatically, people see that as devaluing their own neighborhood. You know, why do you think that perception is so pervasive, Jeff?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think that goes back to the whole, you know, NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Anything that's perceived as kind of less than bringing property values up, people don't want it close to them. But it's also, you know, he also raises the concern about kind of deteriorating conditions. And that, unfortunately, is so common in subsidized housing, which, you know, I think Jessica and her series is going to touch on that. But so, I mean, unfortunately, in Jacksonville, there's good reason to be concerned about that, because so much of the subsidized housing really is deteriorating and seemingly pretty quickly.
And going back to that question of, is it just a handout? There are a lot of rules that residents who live in subsidized project-based housing must follow. I remember one example, Catherine, you told me somebody was threatened because she swore on the property. Can you tell me about that?
That's correct. I represented a woman who lived in public housing who had a verbal altercation that involved cursing. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of rules and regulations that apply to subsidized housing that don't apply to other housing because of the receipt of federal funds. And certainly many of those regulations are necessary. Unfortunately, not all of them are black letter rules, and they can be applied in ways that may not be in the best interest of either the housing establishment or the tenant.
And so somebody said a curse word, and that was grounds for...
I mean, isn't that a First Amendment issue, almost?
That certainly is an issue in that case. Fortunately, we were able to resolve it pre-suit, by doing sort of informal negotiations involving the tenant, learning about other ways to deal with things, and the housing authority, I assume, recognizing that the best course of action was not to make that person homeless. There was not a touching. No one was injured. But yes, there are a lot of onerous rules that apply to subsidized housing tenants, from reporting changes in your income to reporting, if a family member moves out, to recertifying every year, making sure you give copies of all kinds of paperwork. And it can be overwhelming for even the most organized tenant to accomplish.
Right. We've got another call. Bob, you're on the line.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could describe the average tenant that uses Section 8 or subsidized housing and what other benefits they may be receiving.
Thank you. So how do these kind of benefits like overlap? Somebody that is on some type of form of public housing may also be drawing other benefits, maybe on disability or other things. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jeff?
Sure. That is a good example. A lot of folks are disabled. Some folks, that's what is kind of the cause of their low income. Their limited ability to earn income is a disability. So they may have Social Security benefits for that disability. A lot of folks who receive housing assistance are also getting food stamps, basic food assistance. Some get temporary cash assistance. There may be others that I'm not thinking of. Those are probably the most common that sort of overlap in a family that's in subsidized housing.
And, this also, we have to address the fact that this disproportionately affects certain segments of our population. Certain minority segments of our population are disproportionately affected by issues with public housing. Can you talk to a little bit about that, either you, Jeff, or Catherine, about your experiences with that?
A large part of our clientele would be single African-American women with children. That's a lot of the subsidized housing cases that we see. And I think it's interesting to circle back to something Jeff said earlier, thinking about the practical things you have to worry about when you are a low-income mom. You've got to figure out how to get childcare. If anyone is listening and has children, they know how just overwhelmingly expensive that can be to get any childcare, let alone quality childcare. So you've got people working for our minimum wage, attempting to pay their bills, buy food, and put their kids in some sort of safe childcare. And I don't even know how it can be possible.
And going on to the next part of our series, so we talked to a mother who felt like she must leave her subsidized housing rather than risk getting evicted. In the next part of our series, though, we look at what happens if you do get kicked out of that subsidized housing, or for whatever reason you choose not to take advantage of the subsidized housing that's available. So maybe you are a low-income person and you are deciding to look for housing on your own. And I think that gets to something that, Jeff, when we spoke earlier, you kind of called the last resort housing in a way, and it's often just deplorable conditions. And I spoke with Annette Nathan. We'll hear from her later in this week. She lives with five of her children and one of her granddaughters. And she's lived in three houses in the same neighborhood, and she says they just keep getting worse.
Ceiling collapsing, roof need repairing, water coming in when the rain fall. That's house number two. And now this one has been the worst.
So she's in her third house now. She is dealing with a pipe that burst inside of her wall, and it was leaking into the bedroom wall of her granddaughter's bedroom. She says her two-year-old granddaughter has asthma because of this. The landlord, whenever she would complain to the landlord, she started to withhold rent eventually after months of not getting this dealt with. And she just kept getting threats of eviction from her landlord. And Jeff, you are representing her?
Working with her, yes. And unfortunately, that is, you know, you mentioned the whole idea of kind of last resort housing. And it's frustrating because, you know, folks in subsidized housing, they're dealing with usually a corporate entity, usually a pretty organized property that you would think has resources, has staff, has, you know, the means and the will to keep a place up. Well, it seems like, unfortunately, if folks get evicted from there, they end up in this sort of underworld, it seems like, of all of these just individually owned, lots of single family houses on the north and west side that are like what Ms. Nathan is describing, that just, you know, whether the landlord doesn't have money himself or herself to fix it up or just is neglecting it. And there are so many houses, like she describes, all over these neighborhoods on the north and west side. And so people tend to kind of bounce around between those. You know, you rent one of those and it's awful and you may move. And what you get next may be, you know, the same thing, mm-hmm. especially if you've been evicted and you have a hard time getting back into this kind of bigger system that's more organized and has more, you know, background checks and that kind of thing. And so that's the frustrating system that we see people trying to navigate a lot.
And the situation you describe causes a cascade of further problems. You know, your pipe burst, it destroys your clothing, your bed, et cetera. You know, the ability of an unsophisticated tenant to recoup those losses is very limited. And of course, the landlord knows that.
And they, you know, what kind of protections? And I understand that we have some calls, and we'll go to your calls in just a moment here about low-income housing in Jacksonville. But what recourse does a tenant have when a pipe burst and their clothes or other personal items are destroyed or affected by this?
Well, one thing tenants can do when conditions become uninhabitable is to withhold rent. You've got to be really careful when you do that. The law is specific about the kind of notice you have to give before you withhold rent. We see a lot of tenants come in after they've already withheld rent without giving written notice, which is why I say come to Legal Aid early. We can give you forms. We can give you advice. As far as getting back money for property lost, you're left to file a lawsuit in small claims or other court to get that money back, which can be burdensome for someone who can't take time off of work to do that, go to court, go to the hearing, get their witnesses together. That's not an easy process to do.
And really quickly, before I go to our callers here, how is it, I think people, when they saw the news about Eureka Gardens and Washington Heights, they were surprised and they had questions about how a complex like that can get away with some of the violations and some of the structural problems with their apartments. And as I said at the beginning of the segment, it's not just those two complexes. You're seeing this almost across the board. So how is it that this can happen?
I think there are a number of reasons, but one overwhelming reason that everyone can do something about is we're not paying attention. Eureka Gardens didn't happen in a day, it didn't happen in a week, and it didn't happen in a year. It happened over decades. And we have a responsibility as Jacksonville citizens to keep an eye on where our tax dollars are going, for one, where low-income people are living. A lot of those tenants are children. We need to take a special focus and make sure that we're remembering all of the people who live in Jacksonville.
All right, and we'll go to your calls now. Dale and Avondale, you are on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'd like to address the last point there as far as Eureka Gardens is concerned. I myself was not surprised by the conditions in Eureka Gardens and a lot of these other federally and state subsidized housing complexes, and they have been atrocious for many years here. I grew up on the east side of Jacksonville, which would now be considered an economically depressed area. But when I was growing up, we didn't see it as that. My mother and father worked very hard to provide a living for us. And, you know, if we, in other words, if we were poor, we didn't know it.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I saw that when it first started over in Eureka Gardens and these other complexes that they're now looking into, you know, but the one thing that I saw consistently, and I myself as an African-American, was somewhat depressed by that. Young women, unmarried, with multiple children.
Right.
Small children. I think that there's something to be said there as far as, you know, there is a certain degree of responsibility that we must take upon ourselves.
Right. Well, thank you, Dale, for your call. Thank you, Dale, for your call. We've only got a couple more minutes left here. So how about that? How that you mentioned it earlier that this also disproportionately affects single parents, single mothers more than it does any other population. Why is that, do you think, in your experience?
I think those issues are deep and complex, and certainly we wouldn't have enough time or expertise at this table to discuss all those things, but I think that we have to be cognizant of the differences in services and opportunities that are available to the residents of Jacksonville, and not to point fingers at people who are doing their best to live their lives with the laws that we have in place and with the opportunities that we have in Jacksonville. I would just leave it there.
All right. And Jessica, before we wrap up, yep. what is the thing that surprised you most doing this series?
I think what struck me is something we've kind of been hinting at so far, and it's something Jeff said during my interview with you, Jeff, which was that Jacksonville is almost two worlds, and a lot of people don't realize that, because if you're living in your world, that's all you see, and you don't know that there's parts of the town that are in really, really bad conditions. So we're going to hear about some of those bad conditions throughout this series, but we're also going to look at some of the solutions, some of the organizations who are trying to use all of the funding that they can from different sources, from federal, state, local, and nonprofit and private sources, to try to encourage people to move back to economically depressed areas of town and to help people get affordable housing that's also livable. So it's not a completely depressing series. Please tune in this week. It's running Tuesday through Friday. It's called Chasing the Dream during Morning Edition here on WJCT.
All right. Jeff, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I was just going to thank you all for, you know, taking time and spending work on this and shedding more light on it. I think it's really exciting to see just kind of more attention being brought to this. You know, the whole Eureka Gardens scandal was very sad, but maybe a good thing in that we're looking at this more, and more people are now aware of something that, like Catherine said, has been going on for a long time. So thank you all for doing that.
And that's WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo and Catherine and Jeff Haney from Jack's Area Legal Aid. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, One Girl's Mission to Mars. Taylor Richardson tells us how she became so passionate about the Red Planet and what she's doing to ensure she gets a spot on the first mission there. But up next, First Coast Success profiles the Jack's Chamber's Audrey Moran. We'll be right back.
Who is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
Computers are taking over all kinds of work once reserved for humans, so how are they at writing poetry? A new writing contest pits man...
Adjust my aperture towards the deep sky.
Against the machines.
Create an endless voting paradox until...
Come on, humans! The results later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, filling in for Melissa Ross. She's a major voice in the city's business community. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Mathis of the Daily Record speaks with Jack's Chamber Chairwoman, Audrey Moran.
Audrey McKibben Moran is one of the highest profile women in Jacksonville's political, legal, business, and social responsibility environments. She served in legal leadership roles in corporate and private practice and with the State Attorney's Office and the City of Jacksonville. She ran as a candidate for mayor of the City of Jacksonville in a race eventually won by former Mayor Alvin Brown. She is the 2016 chair of the Jack's Chamber, one of four women to have served in that capacity since 2001. Moran also has been Senior Vice President of Social Responsibility and Community Advocacy for Baptist Health for almost 5 years. Audrey Moran, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
You are known to speak out about community issues, including one of the highest profile topics of recent years, and that is the expansion of Jacksonville's human rights ordinance to include the LGBT community. The Jack's Chamber Board supports the expansion, but Mayor Lenny Curry has said an expansion is unnecessary and instead supports a policy barring discrimination in city hiring. What are your thoughts today?
While the Chamber does continue to be strong advocates for a fully inclusive human rights ordinance in Jacksonville, not only is it the right thing to do, it's great for business, wonderful for our city and its citizens, and it's long beyond time for us to have such an ordinance in place. So we're continuing to work on that. It's a behind-the-scenes effort right now. But I think once fall comes, you will see that effort take front and center stage again in our community. There's certainly been an awful lot of things happening on the national stage that has drawn attention to the need for those equal rights. And I'm so proud of the Chamber of Commerce, Karen, because it has had a 135-year history on leading on issues related to social justice and equal rights. So this is a continuation of a long legacy.
Talk about the need for leaders to speak up about issues that are important to them. And those views may not always be popular or widely accepted, but why is it important to step up and make a statement?
Well, if you're in a position of leadership, you're in a position of influence. And I believe when you hold that, you are obligated to speak out on issues, even if they might not be issues that are comfortable or popular. With influence comes a responsibility to stand up for what you believe is right and what you believe is important. And that's sort of the signal to me of real leadership. I think we've had a good history in Jacksonville of people who are willing to stand up and maybe go a bit against the fray. But when you know it's right, know in your heart of hearts that your motives aren't personal, but your motives are really for the greater good, at the end, you'll get there. It may be slower than you want it to be, but you'll get there.
Is it easy?
No. No, it's not. It's never easy to take the point on something that might be controversial, but easy isn't any measure of success. You have to do what you believe is right. And as I see young people growing in influence in this community, I see them stepping up to take the point on issues that are of importance. I also think it's important for leaders to not ever be labeled as a one-issue person. I think it's important that leaders, if they're thinking of the greater good and the greater good in our community, they need to be taking a broad look at issues that affect people all across our community. This is an issue that is important to our whole community, but there's lots of other issues as well. And I've told many people, including Mayor Curry, that once our all-inclusive rights ordinance is passed, we'll move on to other important issues as well.
Well, the Jack's Chamber is more than 130 years old, and the first woman to serve as chair was Carol Thompson, who also at the time was a Baptist Health executive, and that was in 2001, just 15 years ago. Do you see more women in line to serve in that role and in other citywide leadership positions?
I do. I think it's not something to be proud of that I'm only the fourth woman in 130 years. We're working to change that. This important, very important part of Jacksonville's path to becoming one of the greatest cities in the United States is embracing diversity in every way. And one of the privileges you have as chair is to help select your board of directors each year. And when I joined the Chamber Board 2 years ago, there were 14% women on the board of directors. Today, there's 42%. Women on the board of directors. And that was easily done. We have remarkable women in leadership in our community. But it's more than just gender diversity. We've brought in lots of younger people. It can't just be people in their 50s and 60s guiding the economic development future of our community. We need young entrepreneurial voices at the table, and they are. It's race, it's sexual orientation, it's age, it's small business and large business. The more diverse we make the chamber board, the stronger it's going to be. And I think that diversity conversation is so interesting, Karen, because for so many years in our community, it's been about, oh, that's the right thing to do. That's the ethical or moral thing to do. And that's all true. But it's also the right call for business. We know that businesses are stronger and better, make more money, do better in the stock market when they have more diverse boards of directors. And so one of the things I've done and my predecessors have done is work to make sure the chamber board reflects those best business practices.
Now, you ran a very high-profile campaign for mayor. What sort of lessons did you take away from that?
That running for political office is one of the hardest things a person can do, and we need to be grateful when good people stand up and make that kind of sacrifice, both personally and professionally. I thought I knew a lot about political campaigns because I've worked on so many, but when you're the candidate, it's very, very different, and it's very hard not only on you, the candidate, but on your family. So it's an enormous sacrifice, and I'm really conscious of saying thank you to people who stick their neck out and run now and tell them how grateful I am for what they've done. My run for mayor is something I have no regrets about, and that was really important when I started. I wanted to run a campaign that I would not look back and say, if only I, or I wish I. And I haven't done that. I wish I'd won. I didn't win, but I loved the experience in many ways. I met people that I never would have met otherwise. I became intimately familiar with the significant issues facing our community, and I got to relearn how much I love the city.
Well, Audrey Moran, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
And that's the Daily Record's Karen Mathis speaking with Jack's Chamber Chair Audrey Moran. Coming up after the break, 12-year-old aspiring astronaut Taylor Richardson talks about her goal of reaching Mars. Back in a moment with more First Coast Connect.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Hello, this is Todd Smith, your Deputy Director for the City of Jacksonville's Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable foods, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. NASA says the first Intrepid explorers who'll make the 139 million mile journey to Mars are already alive. Some independent nonprofits are working to train prospective Martian transplants how to survive the journey and thrive on the red planet. One local girl, Taylor Richardson, is already prepping for the journey, and she's only 12 years old. Taylor, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thank you.
So you've racked up more than 100 hours of community service, donated more than 700 books to children throughout the community. You're an honor student at Fletcher Middle, a Girl Scout, and a triathlete. I gotta ask, like, how do you have all the time for that?
I'm magical, I guess.
I would say that's pretty magical. I don't think I could do that much when I was your age. So why Mars?
Well, ever since I started reading books about my idol, Dr. Mae Jemison, the first African-American female astronaut, I just got inspired about space and wanted to be the first African-American girl to go to Mars.
So were you fascinated about space before then, before you started reading that?
Right.
But what about Mars? What made you fascinated with Mars? Because there's astronauts that they can go up to the International Space Station and do other missions. Do you think it was just the adventure of it all?
Yeah, I think it was just the adventure.
Yeah, okay. Well, you are aspiring to be the first African-American woman to Mars. But do you think that someone might beat you there first?
No, I think I'm going to be the first one there.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me a little bit about what you like to do in school. What are your hobbies? I mean, do you have time for any other hobbies?
Well, I might, but right now I collect books for kids who can't afford them or don't have them. Well, collect and read. And yeah, that's pretty much all.
So how did you get involved with collecting books? What made you think that there were kids that needed these books?
Well, about a year ago, I saw a kid who didn't have a book, and I don't think they could read very much, so it just inspired me to collect books.
And so you've collected 700 so far, and where do you take them to? Do you take them to a nonprofit, to libraries?
Libraries, different organizations, schools.
Well, you've won some pretty prestigious awards, too. One in particular, I'm thinking you went all the way to Tallahassee for, right? Or
mm-hmm, the Volunteer Award.
So you were there with the governor and the CFO mm-hmm. and the agriculture commissioner. How did that feel?
I was excited. It was an honor to meet those people.
Yeah, did you talk with them about you wanting to go to space? Or?
Yeah, I told them my dream was to go to Mars.
Yeah, well, they were supportive of that, I'm sure. That's mm-hmm. why they gave you the award. So what are you doing to train for this mission? Are you doing anything? I mean, obviously, you're already a triathlete, so I assume you're probably in good shape for space. But
yeah,
what are you doing specifically?
Going to space camps and centers.
Okay, so where? What space camps are you going to, and what are you practicing?
I went to the space camp in Alabama and the one in... Where? Florida. I went to the Kennedy Space Center, and now I'm going to the one in Texas.
Wow, that's a lot of traveling, too. So what is your favorite subject in school? And I think I have an idea.
Science.
So how did you get interested in science? Were you always interested in science since you were a little kid? Or?
Yeah, I was always just curious about what's about our outside world and stuff like that. I was just curious.
And so how do you think your life experience thus far, aside from just the training, you know, your upbringing and your wonderful mother, how do you think that's prepared you for a mission to Mars?
Pretty good, I guess. I think I'm ready.
Yeah. Do you ever think about how it's a heck of a long way away? From your mom and from your friends and other people, or you're just focused on getting there?
I'm just focused on getting there. I try to stay positive.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, how do you think your goals have been shaped by your interest in science? Yeah. you're just interested in space and science, but... Okay. Do you think that your story, you know, talking here on this show and other shows that you've been on and the awards you've won, do you hope that maybe inspires other girls that maybe a little bit younger than you to aspire to the same type of science and engineering and math?
Just inspires girls to know that they can do whatever they put their mind to and just never give up.
Well, thanks, Taylor, for joining me, and good luck to you. I'm sure you will reach your goal.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll look at the week in sports with Cole Pepper. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Barbara Cook talks about going from Broadway ingenue to sophisticated cabaret singer. She was in the original Broadway production of The Music Man and in Candide and Carousel. She's written a new memoir and at 88 is still performing. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Beatings, stabbings, riot squads. We go inside a prison on lockdown, spiraling out of control. An unfiltered look at America's troubled corrections industry. On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Folk musician Frank Thomas has been writing and performing songs about Florida for nearly 40 years. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Frank Thomas. We'll look at historic maps depicting the Atlantic world and revisit the Ice Age archaeological site in Vero. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, filling in for Melissa Ross. And finally this hour, big news about the Jaguars' new indoor practice field.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Our regular sports analyst, Cole Pepper, is here now with that and other news from the week. Welcome, Cole.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Yeah, the Jaguars, for years, basically every coach they've ever had has wanted an indoor practice facility. And anybody who spent particularly August, September in Jacksonville knows why, with afternoon rains and storms and so forth that can pop up, and the heat. And finally, that's going to be done, and now we know when it's going to happen, and should open in April. So the Jaguars will have their last training camp without an indoor practice facility starting in about a month or so, and then they'll have to endure the season. But it's interesting, I remember a time when Tom Coughlin, the first Jaguars coach, got so desperate because of rains and heat for practice that he actually took the team to the Prime Osborne and practiced in the lobby of the Prime Osborne Convention Center. So this has been a long time in coming, certainly. It's also going to double as an amphitheater. There will be events that will be held there. And one of the events that they talk about potentially holding there is the NFL Draft, which is now beginning to travel around the country. It's in Chicago this past year. Traditionally, it's been in New York, but the league has now decided that this is such a big event that they need to move it around like they do the Super Bowl.
And that's new, too, right? That's a new thing. The yep. NFL Draft wasn't really something that people necessarily watched live or got all these live updates or how did that work?
Actually, just the opposite. They had always, for the last 30 years, watched it. There'd been televised coverage of the NFL Draft, but what they're doing now is finding different host cities, just like they do the Super Bowl, so they move it around, and there were tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 people in Chicago for the draft first day this past year. And it's hosting a major event, and Jacksonville might be in line for that, particularly with the facilities that could be brought up now with the indoor facility and the amphitheater. And one of the other things that will be interesting to see is how the Jaguars deal with this and each coach deals with this going forward. How much time do you spend practicing inside when one of the benefits, particularly early in the season, of practicing and training in Jacksonville is that you can stand the heat and the other team maybe can't. You know, when New England comes down in September, that's usually an advantage. So we'll see how coaches approach that once that practice facility is done.
Right. And are there other differences between, practicing indoors and outdoors? I mean, how is that going to affect the team?
Well, obviously, you're going to practice on an artificial surface. So that's one thing that, can change things. The Jaguars did have an artificial surface on one of their three practice fields when they initially built the new ones there to the north and east of the stadium, but it got so hot. Again, now it'll be under shade and cover. Air conditioning can change the way you practice for sure. So I think it's going to be a benefit for the team, for the players, and just about how it's utilized by the rest of the community.
All right, and you have a Corky Rogers update for us?
Yes, the legendary Bulldogs high school football coach, the winningest football coach in the state of Florida, was hospitalized over the weekend. He was on a vacation in North Carolina, taken to the hospital, was in intensive care as of Saturday night. The hospital is not providing updates since then, but he was listed in serious but stable condition at last known. You may know, Ryan, I call the Bulls games on radio and have for the last four years, and it is really something to see a guy who's been the dominant coach in high school football in Jacksonville for so long, and here he is at the age of 72, now hospitalized.
So let's talk soccer. We have the Copa America final. Argentina, Chile went to extra time,
and then to a shootout and to penalty kicks, and Lionel Messi, the best player in the world, missed his PK, and that was part of Chile winning 4-2 on penalty kicks and defending their Copa America title. Messi has still never won a trophy in a major tournament for Argentina, and he said after the game, this may be the emotions, but he said after the game, he's retiring from playing for Argentina.
And how old is he?
He's 29 years old. He'll still play for Barcelona,
right,
his club team, but at least right now, Lionel Messi's saying, that's it, he's not going to play for Barcelona again. You could just see the anguish on his face after he missed and after Chile won. It was a great tournament, and one of the big things it did, I think, was really open up more conversations about the United States hosting another World Cup. Could be maybe in 10 years, but to have the U.S. Available to host a World Cup, the way that the tournament ran all across the country in so many stadiums and so many venues, including Orlando right down the way here, I think you're going to see the World Cup come back to the United States within the next 10 or maybe 14 years.
All right. Do you have any other updates for us?
Yeah, the Armada did a neat thing for season ticket members on Saturday. They had a cookout, kind of an opportunity to bond with players. This was not just, you know, a chance to grill some meat, but also a chance to really spend some time together. The players really talked about how much they appreciated being able to meet the folks they see in the stands every game. And the Armada begin their fall season on Saturday. They play their next home game on July the 9th at Community First Park. A couple other quick ones, too, Ryan. Sharks lost a heartbreaker to Cleveland. They fumbled inside the five-yard line with 14 seconds to play for what would have been the go-ahead touchdown. Ironic, considering Cleveland's football history has included a lot of fumbles inside the five-yard line. And the Suns lost 3-2 in Mississippi yesterday. They're back home Wednesday at the baseball grounds.
All right. Well, you can follow Cole Pepper on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Ryan.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch video on-demand segments at our partner TVJax.com. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Join us again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.